Hamjambo Nyote, Nasafidi, now Rick Steves. I'm Tom Simpson from San Francisco, California, and that was Swahili for Hello Everybody, I Travel with Rick Steves. Hamjambo Nyote, Nasafidi na Rick Steves.
There's a lot of hikes you can take along the Mediterranean coastline, and one I had never considered until just now was walking the length of Israel. Martin Fletcher did just that in 2 weeks, and he's written a book called Walking Israel, A Personal Search for the Soul of a Nation. Mr. Fletcher is a special correspondent for NBC News, based in New York and Israel, former NBC bureau chief in Tel Aviv, spent 30 years as a foreign correspondent, and kind of capped it all off with this incredible hike. Martin Fletcher, thanks for joining us.
Rick, thanks very much for having me.
I got the sense that you spent a lot of years in Israel doing business, and you realized, hey, now it's time to connect with the people.
Well, that's true, you know, because as a news correspondent for an American network, so much of what we do is focused on the conflict, you know, Israel's war with the Palestinians. But there's a whole different story there, and that's what I wanted to show, the other side of that story.
You kind of mentioned that if you actually get away from the interior, you get away from all that hot news, and you find yourself just on hot beaches.
Great beaches, too, absolutely. Well, look, the thing is this, when the world looks at Israel, we see that nation in conflict, basically focusing on a line to the east of the Green Line, the West Bank, you know, the occupation, the settlements, the fighting. Right. But if you're walking down another north-south line, the coastline, it's a whole different country.
Now, you subtitled your book, A Personal Search for the Soul of a Nation. What did you mean by that?
Well, nothing. I tell you what, the publisher chose that subtitle. And personally, frankly, I hate it. And I had always wanted my son to come with me on my hike down the coast. And the title I had was The Father, the Son, and the Holy Coast. That was what I wanted.
Now, I'd buy that. That sounds like lots of fun. But your son wasn't able to make it with you.
My son couldn't make it. The publisher didn't like it. And we ended up with A Personal Search for the Soul of a Nation. Of course, everybody says, so did you find the soul?
Right.
And the answer, of course, is no.
You're burdened with that one, aren't you? Well, I hope it's worth it in book sales. But you ended up doing this walk absolutely alone then. It took you 2 weeks. It's about like walking the length of Long Island, right?
Well, you know, it's only 110 miles long, the entire coast of Israel, the length of Long Island. But, you know, it has to be, without any doubt, the most interesting 100 miles in the world, I think. You know, when you think of what happened there, the events of the Bible, Alexander the Great, the Crusaders, Saladin, the Ottoman Turks, Napoleon, Israel today, of course. You know, there's no 100 miles in the world that compares in fascination.
So as you were walking, you felt like you could lace together centuries of history from all different ages.
Well, that's what I wanted to do. You know, I wanted to show how the past reflects the present. You know, when I did the walk, I brought three books with me, the Bible, an eyewitness account by a crusader who writing 1,000 years ago, and one of Napoleon's officers writing a couple of hundred years ago. So the book's full of anecdotes and historical details, but mostly it focuses on Israel today and what today can learn from the past.
With those three books, you've got just a good example of the incredible historic diversity on that 100-mile hike.
Yeah, and geographically, it's beautiful, too. And, of course, it's a way of looking at Israel that we just don't see in the media for the most part because we focus on the conflict.
Well, let's talk about that. What's the biggest misperception people might have about the land of Israel if all you ever did was look at TV news?
Well, I mean, almost everybody that goes there has a friend who says, hey, why are you going there? Isn't it dangerous? You know, everybody says that. I mean, people are always calling me up, and viewers, friends of friends, saying, hey, is it safe to visit Israel? And I say, of course it is. Then they come. And then a week later, they call me up again and they say, wow, what a great place. I had no idea. So that's what I wanted to do, to write a book about that great place about which so many people have no idea. The fact is, it can be very dangerous. Obviously, there's a war just about every 10 years in Israel. But at the same time, when there's no fighting going on, which is the vast majority of the time, you know, it's a safe, beautiful, fascinating place to visit.
I can imagine it's reasonably safe. Is it uptight because of their location? Is there a tenseness in general?
Yeah, I would say uptightness is more the word than tension because, you know, after the suicide bombing campaigns, for instance, each restaurant charged its clients a small amount of money to help pay for the security guard at the entrance who would check to make sure no one's carrying a bomb. So that can make some people pretty uptight, I guess, right?
That was the feeling I had in Israel. It's just there was a general uptightness, and it was unfortunate because beautiful people, but just a reality that kind of requires uptightness.
Yeah, they're suspicious. They're careful. They've learned that pays. And to people who are not used to it, it can be very discomforting. And of course, people always complain about the tight security measures on the Israeli airline, El Al. And it is very obnoxious sometimes. But at the same time, people say, well, it is the safest airline in the world on its record. So there's a price to pay for safety, and tension and uptightness comes with it, unfortunately.
Now, when you're considering a two-week walk, I mean, reading your book, I thought, well, you had such a wealth of information about Israel through 3 decades of work there. You had, seems like you had friends in every town. That gave you a huge advantage. But could somebody who's a novice about Israel, who is a good traveler and was doing their reading and had the proper information, how realistic is that to do that hike, take 2 weeks and actually walk the coast of Israel?
Well, I think it's very realistic. It's not a common hike, actually. You know, Israel is a country which enjoys its own geography, if you like. There are plenty of trails or hiking trails. There's one hiking trail that goes from the very north of the country throughout the entire country down to the south. It takes about 6 weeks to 2 months to walk it. The trail I took along the coast is actually, strangely enough, not a well-traveled trail. I mean, people don't really do that. But actually, I'm surprised, having done it, about how beautiful it is and how actually unprepared a lot of the coast is to receive tourists. I mean, I went through small towns where there wasn't anywhere to stay at all. And then I ended up sleeping on the beach, which actually I enjoy, but probably not everybody does.
So there is an actual trail, like, I mean, you go to England and you have a trail, you know, along Hadrian's Wall or something like this. There's actually a trail along the coast of Israel?
No, there isn't. You know, I just followed the beach.
Right.
And there are many places where you can't walk. About 30% of the coast, you can't actually walk along the beach because of the docks, the ports, army installations, navy places, and security installations. So there's a lot of zigzagging. And probably it's not really convenient for someone to say, I'm going to walk the whole coast of Israel, as I did. But it's certainly large parts of it which you can walk, and it's all sandy beaches with nice little cafes and restaurants along the way. And, of course, normally they end up in a nice town. So it's a very pleasant thing to do. But I got to say, I wouldn't recommend anyone do it when I did it. I was going to do it in sort of February, March, early spring. But because of NBC, I was traveling all over the place, so I only got to it in the summer. It was incredibly hot and very tiring, and I wish I'd done it 25 years ago when I was that much younger.
I'm speaking with Martin Fletcher, and we know him from his work at NBC as a foreign correspondent. For 30 years, he's reported mostly from the Middle East, and his new book is Walking Israel, Personal Search for the Soul of a Nation. Martin spent 2 weeks walking 100 and some miles down the coast, and, you know, I bet this was a chance for you to really meet kind of the salt-of-the-earth Israeli people, and I've always been charmed by the nickname for them. They call each other Sabra. Do you know about that story?
Yeah, of course, but the fruit, prickly on the outside and soft and sweet on the inside. You know, I would say it's more like prickly on the outside and less prickly on the inside.
I don't know what fruit that would be, but it's kind of a nice image, that cactus fruit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's the people that have such a harsh history that you mentioned in your book, you know, a stranger will break the ice by asking, so how did your family survive the Holocaust? I mean, that's just hard to imagine.
Yeah, that's true. And that really did happen to me. You know, I was in a room full of strangers, and we were beginning to break the ice. And the question that went around was exactly that. So, you know, how did your family survive the Holocaust? And everybody went around the table giving their story. And there's a real message to that, too, isn't there, of course? That first of all, it's a very unifying question.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like how much do you earn or what do you do, you know, which immediately divides you into an hierarchy, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
That question. But how did you survive the Holocaust? You're all in the same boat at the same time. So it's a very unifying question.
Well, their whole existence since, 1947 has been making a case for their legitimacy there and then defending it. You talked about that Zionist slogan, which I found quite poignant, a people without land for a land without people.
Yeah, it's poignant apart from the fact that there were plenty of people living there who they ignored, unfortunately. Yeah, the reality is was rather different. But the fact is that it was a very powerful slogan at a time when Jews had nowhere to go, and many Jews literally did have nowhere to go.
And now they're living among the vacated homes of Palestinians who used to live there, isn't that right?
To some extent, yes. Yeah, certainly in the early days, less so today, but certainly in the early days, many of the Jews who came from the Holocaust to Palestine, as it was before 48, lived in homes abandoned by the Arabs. And of course, the issue today is that the Arabs, in many cases, want their homes back one day. And so the conflict continues.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're speaking with Martin Fletcher. We know Martin Fletcher from his work as a NBC foreign correspondent who's reported from the Middle East for 30 years. Martin, as I was reading your book, I stumbled upon Eli Avivi. I stayed with Eli Avivi back in 1975, and I dug out my journal and I read this entry because you had an experience with Eli Avivi also. And I just want to read this to you. This is what
I'd love to hear it.
This is what I wrote in my journal as a kid traveling through Israel in 1975. July 10. We checked out of our hostel and headed north. We tried hitching for a while, but the soldiers always get picked up first, and that competition was too stiff for us. We ended up on a bus with a bunch of kids from a kibbutz. The bus dropped us in Nazareth, Jesus' childhood hometown. We wandered around and decided that Nazareth wasn't what it used to be. From there, we bused to the coast, where we met some guys who suggested we stay at Ash Ziv. It was run by a strangely charismatic man named Eli Avivi. The property, which once housed Arabs, was now Eli Avivi's, and he had set up a kind of kingdom, which he declared was an independent country, Ash Ziv land. We walked through the gates of this tiny land and found an old, rundown mansion lit only by candles and with a bunch of people on the rooftop. A girl who looked like the queen of Eli Avivi's harem came to the edge of the roof and hollered down a welcome. A guy came out with a candle and a box of matches. He explained, "You can do anything you want here as long as you don't disturb other people." We paid him the equivalent of $3, and he took us to an old kind of stone shelter with lots of rooms, straw-filled mattresses, and graffiti all over the walls. We picked a fairly nice spot, which is little more than a cave, and lit our candle. Picnicking for dinner on the beach that evening, we could actually hear the bombs from the war. We were very close to the Lebanon border. The beaches here were under very tight security and constantly being scanned by searchlights. When it was time to return to our cave, we passed crazy Eli Avivi in his tiny swim trunks. We said goodnight, and he said, "Shalom."
I love it. I love that.
And you met him in 2010 or something. What is he like now? He was that old hedonistic hippie with all these girls hanging out and lots of nude bathing and everything.
Oh, man, you've given me so many things to talk about with that. That's a wonderful entry. First of all, let me tell you that those hitchhikers who got the lift before you did.
Right.
So when I was there in 74, I picked one of them up and she's still my wife.
My goodness. You were there the year before I was trying to get a ride. All right.
So that's what happens if you give them a ride. So she became my wife. She was a soldier in the Israeli army and very beautiful. So, of course, I hit the brakes and we're still married.
Really? I fell in love with an Israeli draft dodger that same year. And she was one of these hippie young Israeli girls that actually fled Israel to avoid the draft and then went back home. And I met her just outside of there in Haifa. But
I think after this interview, we should call each other up and swap notes. You mentioned the Eli Avivi creating the independent state of Avivistan.
Yeah.
He called it Avivi land, rather.
Okay.
And the Palestinians at the time, they joked that Eli Avivi got independence before they did.
Well, he was very into his independence there because, as that guy mentioned, you can do anything you want here as long as it doesn't bother other people.
And Israelis did go there because in the 50s, he first went there in the early 50s. And at that time, Israelis really didn't have any money to go abroad. They didn't have passports. So they used to go to his place, which became like this alternative lifestyle, naked bathing in the beach and loads of people. When I spoke with him, he told me that he had 1,000 girlfriends and took pictures of them all naked. And he invited me to see his photo album, which I declined.
Are backpackers still hanging out and camping on his beachfront property there?
Yeah. It's still a very famous, well-known place to go for the weekend. But, you know, it's not really all a funny story because the houses that he's living in are literally the abandoned homes of Arabs who ran away to South Lebanon in 1948. And I asked him about that. And he said that, you know, some of those Palestinians who ran away, some of them still do live in the area and sometimes come to visit. And you mentioned that you used to pay $3 to stay there. Mm-hmm. Today, you've got to pay 20 shekels, which is about $7 to visit the national park nearby. And I said to him, isn't it a bit strange that the Arabs who used to live here have to pay 20 shekels to come visit? And he said, well, no, not really. If they used to live here, they only pay half price.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's Eli Avivi land for you.
I thought there was a rather tone-deaf way of looking at it.
Really? Didn't he make a comment you wrote about in your book that there's Arabs in the parliament, in the Knesset, and one day they're going to take it over through peaceful means?
Yeah, he did say that. And of course, by the way, he's echoing what many Arabs say themselves, actually, which is that one day, that's one of the things I learned on my journey down the coast. You know, 1 million of the citizens of Israel are Arabs, about 20% of the population. And one thing they always say is that something will happen. One day something will happen and we'll take our country back. The Jews will go, we'll get our country back. So although it sounds like right-wing xenophobia when Eli Avivi says it, actually it does reflect a certain reality.
So that's that concept of the, quote, enemy within?
Well, it's a very delicate situation because although the million Arabs are there and talk in those terms about, quote, something will happen, nevertheless, I would never call, they are not the enemy within. I mean, for the most part, they're loyal citizens of Israel, definitely who have a second-class status to some extent. But even when they've reached positions of success economically, educationally, they still are somewhat apart. But they're not the enemy. They're just citizens, in many cases disadvantaged citizens, trying to make the best of their life in their country.
And it's much like immigrants in the United States. They may be, in a lot of senses, second-class citizens, but they're the first ones to have an American flag hanging from their shop window. And you wrote in your book how these Israeli Arabs are, in many cases, more loyal to the state of Israel than Israeli Jews themselves.
Well, that was a specific few people I met who had an extremely interesting story that really did draw back some of the layers of society, showing how you can't take every stereotype for granted. But in general, I wouldn't for a moment say that Israeli Arabs, even a large number of them, are more loyal than Israeli Jews. But they're not the enemy within. They're not the fifth column. They're just a minority group trying to make the best of a not very good situation for themselves.
And that's probably a very good example of how you can take these very complicated and confusing issues and find a little more clarity if you actually travel there and talk to the people you meet on the beach or in the villages.
No, absolutely. And that's exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to look at situations with which I was familiar from a fresh point of view. You know, take the time, walk slowly, meet new kinds of people, and understand familiar issues in a much deeper way. And I have to say, I felt that I succeeded. You know, I went down the coast, visited each community, and dealt with issues which I normally, as a news reporter, never deal with. When I did come across issues, like, for instance, I was in Ashkelon when Israel suddenly went to war with Hamas in Gaza. Normally, I would report that as a news reporter. The bombs are falling here, so many dead, so many injured, you know. But because I was in this mode of writing the book, I went to this one cafe every day for 3 weeks and spent the entire war with a group of people inside the cafe, most of whom, by the way, were Jews from Arab countries, and saw the entire conflict through their eyes, which I wrote about in one of the chapters. And I learned so much. And I must say, you know, I think that although I've been a reporter now for, I really don't want to say how long, but let's say 40 years, about 30 years of which I've actually been living in the Middle East, I really feel that this was the best reporting I've done in this book. And I don't say that just to sell the book, but I mean, for me, it was a wonderful experience to pull back, slow down, walk the coast, which took 2 weeks. Then I spent a year researching the issues and the people and the places. You know, I think it was by far the deepest reporting I've done.
It's interesting you say that because I spent 2 weeks with a public television film crew in Iran. And the things I learned, not dealing with, you know, terrorism and Israel and Baha'is and Jews and gays issues, but just learning about what makes the people tick, I humanized that country and learned far more than I think I've learned in watching 100 years of Ted Koppel and Nightline.
Thank you for not mentioning Martin Fletcher in that list.
We continue walking south toward Gaza, exploring the coast of Israel with Martin Fletcher. There's more just ahead on Travel with Rick Steves.